You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kasa tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Datu Tuesday. I'm your host Kasa and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Sophia. He Whaia Kane coming up on the show for Dear Science this week. Professor Ellen Blackman chats to us about daylight savings, handwriting for students, and a strange development in for ladybugs. I speak to CEO of Safe for Animals, Deborah Ashton, about the organisation and their recent petition against the potential repeal of the live export ban. I also speak to Dr. Rob Beaglehole, a spokesperson for the New Zealand Dental Association, about sugary drinks in schools going into World Oral Health Day. Sophia, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Haka expert and University of Auckland professional teaching fellow of Māori studies, Paura Sharples, about political expression through Haka. I also speak to co-president of the New Zealand Association of Scientists, Professor Troy Baisden, about the impending expiry of national science challenges and the future of science research funding.
He aha o whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give me a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihere rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Kester.
Hi. Sorry, this is my first time meeting you in studio.
Indeed, likewise, and Sophia as well. Yes, indeed. Mm. So, my goodness, the numbers of the presenters I've been through on this show, it's getting to ridiculous proportions. But good to have you guys, and let's talk science.
Yeah, so what have you got for us about daylight savings?
Well, let's talk about daylight saving, because it's gone in a couple of weeks, and so that means that, it's going to be getting darker sooner, which I hate. That sucks. Mm. But getting up at the moment is tough because it's pitch black out there. And so, you know, when that's gone, that means that you're going to be getting up in the light for a while anyway. So it's not that big a thing in New Zealand, this whole daylight saving thing. I know that you were saying, Kester, that you are a fan.
Yeah.
And you're
not.
And, and no, it's Jess that wasn't a fan. Yes. Indeed. But little old New Zealand, I mean, we're stuck in one time zone. We're a very sort of narrow country, so there's not a big difference in sort of times, let's say, across the country. You know, you've got East Cape as the easternmost point, and you've got, you know, somewhere down in Fiordland and as the westernmost point. We don't span more than one time zone. Whereas you get countries that do, like, you know, the States and Russia and stuff like that. They've been doing studies there to see whether it makes any difference whether you live basically on the east hand, on the east of a time zone, or at the very west of a time zone, right next to the next door time zone, as it were. And so seemingly these people have done these studies, and they're finding out that if you live in the very, very west part of a time zone, that basically you're more susceptible to car accidents, of all things. And the reason then being that essentially what you've got is that if you're on the west of a time zone, that means that the sun's going to go down later than it would be at the east.
Right.
Okay. And the sun's going to come up later as well. Okay. So you're going to be getting up in the dark and you're going to be going to bed maybe still while it's light. Okay. And so, in other words, you don't want to go to bed when it's light, do you?
No.
Nobody wants that. And so therefore, if you live on the west-hand side of a time zone, chances are what you're going to be doing is you're going to be going to bed later because you don't want to go to bed while it's still light, but you've still got to get up at the same time where it's going to be pitch black, you've had less sleep, you're tired, and so therefore this is the hypothesis anyway, is that you're going to be more likely to be involved in car accidents and stuff. And this is how they explain that. So they've actually, you know, done the science, and they found that, yes, you are more susceptible to being in car accidents if you live on the west hand side, or the, it's not west hand side, the west of a time zone, okay? And so this is kind of the whole daylight saving thing in miniature, really, because, you know, that's essentially what we're doing. When we go into daylight saving and out of daylight saving, we're basically changing a time zone. And again, studies have shown that when you do change from daylight saving either forward or backwards, then in those few weeks around that time, that yes, there does seem to be an increase in accidents and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's the same sort of thing, and we find that this really does affect some people. Some people seem totally oblivious to it. I don't seem to mind it. I seem to be okay. I can cope with it. But it really does get to some people, and basically you're sort of interrupting your biological rhythms, because your biological rhythms, we are basically hardwired to get up when the sun comes up and to go to bed when the sun goes down. And I guess that makes an awful lot of sense, because, you know, way back in the day when they didn't have lighting and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, no point staying up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what are you going to do? It's pitch black out there. So we are, to a certain extent, messing with these biological rhythms, as I say, which are hardwired. So what happens, you know, when the clocks go forward, we're getting up before the sun comes up, sort of thing. So we're getting up when it's dark, and that's, you know, that's not what you're used to. And then basically we're going to bed before we're ready to go to bed, sort of thing, because, you know, it's still light, and we shouldn't be in bed, but we think that we have to. So, I mean, there are arguments to be made for and against the whole daylight savings thing, but this seems to be big in the States at the moment. That a bill had been passed by the Senate looking at having permanent daylight saving time. So there's the argument of, I think the States, they have it for quite a long time. They have it for, I think, about 8 months of the year. Mm. And in fact, in 1973, they went to full-time daylight saving time. but then the public found out, oh, heck, I don't like getting up in the winter when it's absolutely pitch black. And so they then reverted to basically 8 months on, 4 months off thing. And so there's this discussion at the moment as well. And on the side of permanent daylight saving time seems to be the politicians, surprise, surprise. And on the side against the permanent daylight saving time, so just staying at standard time the whole time, are, of course, the scientists, who have come up with all sorts of reasons why, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And this is something I never thought of, that the advocates for staying at the normal standard time have said, why don't we then maybe start schools an hour later in the winter?
I'm sure,
or start work an hour later and just go for that hour longer. And that seems to be, to me, extraordinarily sensible.
Quite nice.
Yeah. Would be difficult to do. And again, as somebody said, I mean, this whole thing with time zones and stuff like that, I mean, you know, poor old Australia, you know, they're all up the wazoo, because Queensland doesn't have daylight saving.
Right,
and obviously. And because apparently the argument, well, they held a referendum, I believe, on this, and the argument was that it would fade the curtains because you've got more hours in the day. this was their argument. But, I mean, the worst one is China, because China spans about five time zones and it's the same time in all the time zones. So, in other words, midday, and now how does this work? Yeah, like when it's midday in the east, it's midday in the west and it's still dark, you know? It's crazy. I don't know how they make it work, but they do. But I just thought that, you know, this might be a germane time to sort of bring this up, given the fact that we are coming into the dark days of winter, literally. Yeah, for sure.
And then, obviously, you've got this bit on handwriting for students.
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm a big believer in handwriting, and it's a dying art. And everybody always comments on my handwritten notes.
I was just going to say, they're beautiful.
Yeah,
they're not really. But I always handwrite my notes, because it just helps me remember things. And I've always found that, you know, studying through university and stuff, and dare I say it, when I started, they didn't have whiteboards, they had blackboards, you know.
Yeah.
And we certainly didn't have PowerPoints and stuff like that. So, and I think that the big thing with students now is, right, all the PowerPoints are there and I just have to look at them on the screen and somehow they're going to infuse themselves into my brain, so I just don't have to, you know, do very much. Yep. Just look at them and it'll be there and I'll pass my exams and blah, 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 blah. And I've always said, no, it doesn't work. And the way, if you want to learn, the way to learn is to write stuff down and keep writing stuff down, make notes of your notes and then make notes of your notes of your notes and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just write. And so, as I say, it's something I've always said, and now workers in Norway have thankfully done a study on this and they've shown, yep, I'm right. Basically.
That was good.
So they were looking at the difference between handwriting and typing. And looking particularly at brain activity when you're doing both of those processes. So what happens is that they would have a word on a computer screen and everyone would be hardwired up, so monitoring brain activity, and they would look at the difference between writing that down using a digital pen or typing it out. And they found absolutely that the brain activity was hugely increased when you were writing stuff down, physically writing stuff down, versus just typing it, okay? Mm. And what they found, so it's an increase in brain activity, but specifically it's an increase in brain activity in the areas of the brain associated with learning and memory,
right,
particularly. And so this is sort of saying that something's going on there with respect to memory. They also found that what was happening when you were writing stuff down is that were connections being made in the brain between the outer areas of the brain, which is to do with moving and sensing, and the inner areas of the brain, which are to do with memory, the right, central parts, okay? So, and, you know, as I said, and I quote, on the whole, brain activity is, quote, much, much higher, unquote, for handwriting. And so, you know, the fact that seems to be associated with the memory part of the brain, it just makes sense that if you want to remember something, then write it down and write it down again and write it down again. Mm. And, you know, I hate to sound like an old fogey, I probably am, but, you know, in this digital age and everything like that, it's just all too easy to just sit back and you've got everything presented to you on a platter.
Mm.
You just do. And I think way back when I was in lectures, the actual act of having to copy stuff down in lectures, because the lecturer would be writing stuff on the blackboard and you would have to be writing it down and you would have to be paying attention not only to what was being written down but what they were saying as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were really, really seriously concentrating on what they were doing and what they were saying, and you were just trying to get everything down.
Yeah.
And then chances are what you would do after the lecture, you'd go through and, you know, and rewrite it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it just makes sense. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then lastly, you've got this thing about ladybugs.
Yeah.
I gave that a little read. It was quite interesting.
Yep. Yep.
Strange.
Oh, very. Yes. Mm. Yes. So let's talk about the mealybug ladybird.
Mm.
Okay. And so these live on prickly pear cacti in Spain. Have you ever seen a prickly pear?
No.
They've got nasty. It's like slightly soft and then it's quite...
But the spines on them, they're nasty. You don't want to... No, they're nasty little things. And they're not native to Spain. So they came from the Americas originally, okay, which is important to the story. And this mealybug ladybird is also not native to Spain. It also came from Australia, of all places. Okay, so this mealybug ladybird, now it's busy, you know, chowing down on this prickly pear cactus, and then you've got a few ants coming out and think, oh, there's dinner. And so the ants come out, this ladybird then excretes this red material, okay? And this is called a hemolymph, okay? Mm. And it's full of a compound called carminic acid, and that is nasty. It's toxic and it keeps the ants away, okay? And so far so boring, really, because that's, you know, that's just one of a huge number of sort of chemical defense techniques that have that are known in nature. You know, insects, even animals and stuff like that, you know, they've got these, they utilize chemicals to protect themselves, okay? Now this is a bit different though, because the ladybug doesn't manufacture the carminic acid by itself, okay? So it gets it from somewhere else. Now, again, this is not absolutely unprecedented, because there are other things. There are toads, for example, that can eat venomous insects and stuff like that, and then utilize that venom to save themselves against attack from other things. Now, they can do that because they've co-evolved, that they have evolved, you know, in a similar part of the world, the ecosystem, call it what you will, and they're evolving together, and they've evolved to so they've got this sort of symbiotic relationship. Well, it's not too symbiotic because the bugs get eaten, but the toads can utilize that because as a result of evolution. But the big difference here is that nothing is native to Spain in this case. The ants are, okay, but the prickly pear is not, and then your ladybug's not. And so what happens, how does the ladybug get this carminic acid?
Yeah.
It gets it from eating cochineal bugs. Now, if you've heard of cochineal...
Maybe.
Food colouring.
Yeah.
So red food colouring, that's what we used to use for red food colouring. You used to crush up these bugs and everything and cochineal. Now, it just so happens that these cochineal bugs are full of this carminic acid.
That we've been eating, or
now they can manufacture it. Okay, so when the ants come out, the ants keep away from the cochineal bugs. Okay, but the ladybugs, they chew them up for breakfast, their breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're quite happy eating the cochineal bugs. Now, the cochineal bugs were again, they came from the Americas on the prickly pear. Okay, and so we've got these ladybugs that came from Australia, okay, relatively recently and everything, and now they're able to chow down on these cochineal bugs, ingest this carminic acid, and then use it for a defense mechanism for themselves. And this is the first time that this has been seen, that this is the first example where you've got no evolutionary history. They haven't evolved together. They've come from completely different parts of the planet, but somehow these guys have now got an immunity to this carminic acid, and they can utilize it themselves. So this is chemical warfare at its best, really.
It's incredible.
Very, very impressive stuff. So a nice little story to end on.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for coming in today, Alan.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Moshet.
Here.
And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Sorry, Mittens, our plan has failed.
Rats! Why couldn't she just forget me? All I want is to be a street cat.
We'll need a new plan.
I've got it. All we need is a realistic life-size cutout of me.
First, we'll need the perfect photo. I'll head to ProGear. Oh, yes, perfect. More paw. Lovely. You're a natural.
ProGear Photographic. For photos so crisp, you'll think they aren't photos. Head to ProGear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Ah, the environment. Without it, we are like a fish without water.
Or just a human without water.
A human without air?
We need both.
Well, in that case, it's good that EcoFest is coming this March. EcoFest is a huge array of amazing events and activities to appreciate and contribute to the environment in our beautiful city. Explore, discover, create, appreciate, and spark sustainability in your neighbourhood. EcoFest, on now till April 14. Discover what's on at ecofest.org.nz.
Here comes the boss with a musical star.
Crisp biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim.
The original.
95.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Because that's the big deal here. Dolphin orgies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The previous Labour government introduced a ban on the live export of animals, with former Agriculture Minister Damien O'Connor claiming the ban upheld New Zealand's reputation for animal welfare standards. The current National-led government has been pressured by several lobbying groups to overturn the ban, including a $1 million campaign by Livestock Export New Zealand. I speak to Safer Animals CEO Deborah Ashton about SAFE, the possible repeal, and consequences for the animals involved. Could you briefly explain what SAFE does?
SAFE is an animal rights organisation, so we work very, very hard to educate and inform people about issues that impact on animals, and we work very, very hard to ensure we can get positive change for animals.
Why should we have a ban on the live export of animals?
Well, there are a number of issues that are concerning for animals who are involved in live export. From their perspective, it's absolutely horrific for them. The journey itself on board those live export ships can be quite horrendous for those animals. They're forced to live in close confinement. They're in an environment that they're not familiar with at all. They're also put at risk of things that can happen at sea beyond anybody's control, whether it's breakdowns or adverse weather conditions. All of these sorts of things can have adverse effects on animals, which is why we're really concerned about the way animals are being transported. Secondly, we've got big concerns about the way that animals are treated in destination countries. So where we typically send animals to are countries that have little to no animal welfare standards that ensure that they are protected. They're likely to be living in indoor farms. They're not going to be out grazing in paddocks like we pride ourselves in here in New Zealand. So it really is quite a different type of environment for those animals. And those types of conditions, whether they're on board the ships or at the destination, don't align with the obligations and the requirements of our Animal Welfare Act and how we expect to see animals being treated.
Is the government looking into repealing the ban on live export?
Yeah, so unfortunately the government is looking at repealing the ban. We've got very big concerns around that. There was a lot of work from all sorts of quarters that went into achieving a ban on live export in the first place. Now we've got, a new government. They are actually talking about bringing live export back. There will be a consultation process undertaken by the government, is our understanding. So there will be time for people to give their opinions and their expertise on what they think about live export.
Is there a huge support amongst farmers for repealing the ban on live export?
Yeah, so we understand that there's a small minority of farmers that actually do support live export. So SPCA did do some polling on this, and they did find that actually there was only, I think it's around 22% of farmers that are most likely to support live export. It's quite interesting, I think, to see that so many other farmers and people in rural communities don't support a return to live export based on animal welfare issues and the fact that it could be seriously bad for our reputation internationally.
What is SAFE doing to oppose the potential repeal?
Well, we've been talking with a lot of key decision makers around live export. We've done that for a long time. That's typically what we do here at SAFE. But we've also been talking to members of the public who have deep concerns for animals being sent on board those ships. We are encouraging people to sign a petition that's on the parliamentary website. That petition belongs to the former chair of the National Animal Welfare Advisory Committee, John Hellstrom. He is opposed to live export. He's a former vet. He's been over to China. He doesn't agree with live export at all. And so we are encouraging people to sign that petition to make sure that their voice is heard with this government.
All right. Did you have anything you wanted to add?
I think the world is watching to see what the New Zealand government decide to do. This ban was the first of its kind, and it positioned us as a world leader in animal welfare. We've seen other countries follow our lead. We've got the United Kingdom, who are just going through the process now to ban live export by sea. Australia is looking at banning live export of sheep. There's Luxembourg and Brazil. They're all taking steps to phase out live animal exports. So our question would be for this government, why on earth, after being such world leaders in this space, would we want to bring such an awful and highly risky trade back to this country?
That was CEO of Safe for Animals, Deborah Ashton, speaking about Safe and the possible live export ban repeal.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Earlier this month, the women's super rugby or picky team, Hurricanes Poa, kicked off their season with a new haka calling out the coalition government, raising concerns about its policies on Te Reo Māori and acknowledging he whakaputanga and Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Additionally, last week, a school in Palmerston North, Freyberg High School, performed a protest haka to visiting ACT leader David Seymour over his party's policies on Te Tiriti, education and workforce issues. I speak to haka expert and University of Auckland Professional Teaching Fellow of Māori Studies and Contemporary and Traditional Māori Performing Arts and Language, Paora Sharples, about the use of haka as political expression, how it's been received, and movements led by rangatahi. The women's super rugby or picky team, Hurricanes Poa, rewrote their haka to call out the, quote, puppets of this redneck government, acknowledge he whakaputanga, and refer to Toitū Te Tiriti. Their haka has resurfaced conversations similar to those surrounding the 1981 Springbok tour about whether politics should mix with sports. Where do you sit in this debate?
You know, there'll always be a case for controversial statements to be made, especially using a haka as the vehicle of expression. The very nature of haka is to be controversial, so, you know, to deny or forbid that aspect of it is to, like, deny its true makeup, its purpose and intent. So examples like this that you've seen recently really show that haka can be expressed in many different ways and often political, often controversial.
And with regards to the Freyberg High School protest haka, ACT leader David Seymour has said the students got overexcited from seeing a politician they recognised, to which a student has responded saying this commentary is patronising. What does Seymour's interpretation of the protest say about the government's understanding of Te Ao Māori and haka? And what do you think it says about how seriously the government receives criticism, particularly from Māori and younger people?
Yeah, I think he was just playing it down there with that statement. At the end of the day, this is a statement that's been made by a young group of people from a particular school that he's visited. And it's another example, I guess, of the feeling that's out there in the community against some of the rhetoric and narrative that's coming through the current coalition government. It's a space where they've felt that they can make that statement. So, you know, other than places like meetings or within Parliament itself, they felt the need to do a haka there and then and express their views. So they took the bull by the horns and they performed their haka.
In addition to that, one of the students spitting at the ground in front of Seymour has been widely discussed in the media with regards to upholding tikanga. Do you think it violates tikanga? What does spitting and haka express, particularly in this context?
Yeah, spitting or tufa is the act of spitting, has been a characteristic and expression of haka since long ago. It sits with other expressions like whakapohane, which is showing your backside, expressing your distaste towards a kaupapa or a person or a particular event. These are all expressions of haka. They're often seen at matatini at the national level, which is the kapa haka. At its excellence level, have you seen tamaiti is often used tufa? So it is part of the haka, an expression of haka in itself. As far as I know, it was done as Mr. Seymour was leaving, and once again they took the opportunity to express their views. But I mean, I can see how it might look to those who aren't versed at seeing something like that. I mean, but if you look at spitting itself, if you go back to the 70s, you know, people got spat out in the face if they didn't like the colour of your skin. That was the reality back in the 70s. It was looked upon as the normal and no consequences would come of it. My father, who was the race relations conciliator at the time, stood up and said, no more spitting in people's faces, especially if you don't like the colour of their skin. So, and that caused an upheaval. But this is, I'm just giving this as an example. Of course, we've come a long way from then. Those were the days when you could get, you know, fired for saying kia ora on the phone. But yeah, this is our history. This is who we are. This is who we were. This is who we are now. And we are still evolving. And it's about working together and working with our tikanga, our customs, and moving forward together.
And we've really seen the strength of the Kohangareo generation coming through with both a new generation of Māori political leaders and an emerging and ongoing youth movements. Do you expect to see a lot more activism and criticism against the coalition government to be led by our rangatahi?
Yeah, I would say I wouldn't be surprised, put it that way. I mean, I've been surprised, well, not surprised and surprised of how much there is. And when you think about it, since the coalition came into being, there have been huge amounts of people that have come together, the likes of Waitangi, Ratana, Ngarawahia, Kingitanga. You know, people in that mass don't gather for nothing. It's a real thing that's happening in the community, worried about some of the narratives that are coming out of the government. So in terms of your question, yeah, we have a new generation of raukura coming through who are not afraid to stand up and put their case forward. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some more haka exemplified over the next weeks, months to come.
That was haka expert and University of Auckland Professional Teaching Fellow of Māori Studies, Paura Sharples, speaking about political expression through haka.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Auckland Council's long-term plan sets the direction for Tamaki Makaurau for the next decade. It's a plan for how Auckland Council will provide services and activities for Aucklanders and how we plan to fund them. There are big choices to make for our long-term plan, 2024 through 2034, and we need your feedback to help us decide. Auckland, it's time to have your say. Go to akhaveyoursay.nz/ourplan to find out more.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again, or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh, no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport, too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mash downs, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m, only on 95BFM.
Zero, 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 0.0005 cents for
worship Jenner. That's the exploitation of me and you. I never understand why they allow it, but it's easy to be fair. You just do it, do it, do it like they can. And if my locker's trying to get me for free, yeah, I'ma smack him in the face like, yeah. If you like this, then where the fuck is my money at? Show me my paper stacks. All this music that I channel for you made me wanna take it back.
Shop all day, we never stop and browse. Champagne kisses, mirror, wine and clouds. It's all about trust, that's why I got you near. Bright idea until you shot it down. Act like they're not around. Call by chance, just like your pocket dial. Did what you had to do to get ahead. Unpredictable, so they call you volatile. No more strain, no more gain than loss. So I pour flames for the change. Sorry for the board games and your shame. I'm all about monopoly, hitting where I aim. In the industry where they take names and profit off your pain. Filming your destruction, but who's really there when the dust ends? Money is a must end. Waiting for my gust to win so we can take off. I'm buckled in. Love when I'm taking all your troubles in.
If you like this, then where the fuck is my money at? Show me my paper stacks. All this music that I channel for you made me wanna take it back. And that's me.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Money by Skeela featuring Guilty Simpson. Many primary schools across the country have implemented water-only policies due to the low nutritional value of sugary drinks and their high impact on hospital visits among children. However, sugary drinks remain available at some primary schools and many intermediate and secondary schools, where they continue to greatly impact students' oral and physical health. I speak to spokesperson for the New Zealand Dental Association, Rob Beaglehole, about sugary drinks in these schools moving into World Oral Health Day. What are some of the risks of sugary drinks in schools?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to be selling sickness to kids in schools. We know that sugary drinks is a form of sickness. It's the number one contributing factor to tooth decay, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. There's no nutritional value in sugary drinks, and what we're calling on is the government to move beyond their ideology and to focus on the pain and suffering that these sugary drinks are causing to kids on a day-to-day basis.
So what are the policies that the New Zealand Dental Association are pushing for, and what are some of the other drinks that maybe they're proposing as alternatives?
Well, ideally, children in schools would be drinking water or unflavoured milks. There's no point in selling sickness in the form of sugary drinks to kids. There's no nutritional benefit from sugary drinks. And we know that the number one source of sugar for youth actually comes from sugary drinks in New Zealand. So this is why the New Zealand Dental Association is calling on the government to instigate a policy, a water-only policy for schools. We know that the government recently adopted a nationwide cell phone ban, cell phone policy, and that was great, and we're calling on the government to do the same thing with sugary drinks.
Is there currently a ban in place on sugary drinks in primary schools?
Currently, the vast majority of primary schools have water-only policies. It hasn't been mandated, but what we're calling on the government to do is to mandate water-only policies, both for primary schools, intermediate schools, and high schools.
Should adults also be avoiding sugary drinks?
Well, ideally, as humans, we should be drinking water, unflavoured milks, or teas and coffees. The odd sugary drink every now and then, fine, but you just need to know that there are risks associated with sugary drinks. It's not just the sugar that we need to be careful of, it's also the fact that they are extremely acidic and sweet.
That was Dr. Rob Beaglehole from the New Zealand Dental Association speaking about sugary drinks in intermediate and secondary schools.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
National science challenges were established in 2014 with the aim to tackle New Zealand's biggest science-based issues and opportunities. They are funded through the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment. The challenges have invested over $680 million of funding over 10 years. However, they are due to expire at the end of June this year. I speak to co-president of the New Zealand Association of Scientists and honorary professor at the University of Auckland School of Environment, Professor Troy Baisden, about the impending expiry, the significance of this loss, and the future of science research funding in Aotearoa. For those who don't know, could you please explain the National Science Challenges and what they intended to do?
The National Science Challenges were a group of 11 different topics or challenges that were to attract scientists and stakeholders to work together to solve some of the biggest problems New Zealand could identify back around 2012. They included areas like the impacts of climate change, uniquely coming from the Southern Ocean across us, making the seas around us sustainable, as well as areas like high-value nutrition and keeping people healthy.
You've slightly touched on this a little already, but what sort of science does this cover? Do you have some examples of current research projects that are funded under these schemes?
Well, I mean, it's hard to pin down any single area of science, but one of the ones that we're most worried about losing is the climate modeling and associated observations that cover large areas of the Southern Ocean. There's also a lot of research that covers seismic hazards and how, and also other natural hazards like storms and floods and volcanoes and how they may play out in New Zealand and how stakeholders can engage to help protect us from those hazards. Those are the types of things that we worry most about losing if indeed anything happens that we suddenly need that research or the information from it.
So the challenges are set to expire at the end of June this year. What is the significance of this loss for not only the science sector, but also for the research and contributions for the wider society?
This is a huge sort of disaster in planning processes around science. There was a process designed to replace these big challenges with something else that would work better than they've worked. One of the problems is possibly that they were underfunded for what they needed to do. And now we're going to cut them away entirely? That doesn't make any sense if, in fact, they were working on the most important areas of research for New Zealand. The other logical thing that comes from that is, what are the people going to do? And we're really looking at a situation where a number of scientists, and particularly the leadership level, are often leaving New Zealand as quickly as possible or have already arranged new positions elsewhere. People are retiring, and there are real questions about what happens to the information and relationships that have been generated while these challenges were running.
How, if anything, is the government replacing contestable funding for science research? What do you hope will be done?
The ideal situation would be two things. One is lifeboats for the areas of critical national capability that would allow the researchers to maintain and continue important research areas that matter both for New Zealand and internationally. The second thing would be to reinvigorate a new process that resembles but doesn't have to be like the process the last government ran called Te Ara Parangi, which was trying to find pathways forward for our national research system, which has been through multiple reorganizations over the last 30 years, each one worse than the last.
So do we know what the government is doing, if anything?
No, there's essentially budget confidentiality around every level of discussion, and that's not doing us any good in the next 2 months while researchers are leaving and institutions are planning their budgets, redundancies, and cuts for the coming year. Most research organizations are planning difficult roadshows or have already announced major programs to cut researchers like the Callaghan Innovation Strategic Reset. No one has any clear strategies from the minister on down. The only strategies seem to be to cut red tape, but what that often means is that only minor changes happen at the management and governance level, and it's the researchers that suffer. And that quality of research and its ability to actually be the front line when New Zealanders need research is what could be lost here. The biggest question is, do we actually need national science challenges to do what's required? And the answer is no. What we do need is a funding level that's commensurate with our with peer nations. And New Zealand has the lowest levels of funding for government and university research of any peer nation. And that's really that issue here, is getting some research in place that's stable, supports researchers and their careers, and can deliver for New Zealand.
That was co-president of the New Zealand Association of Scientists, Professor Troy Baisden, speaking about the impending expiry of national science challenges and the future of science research funding.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, Professional Teaching Fellow of Māori Studies, Paura Sharples, Professor Troy Baisden, Safe for Animals CEO Deborah Ashton, and spokesperson for the New Zealand Dental Association, Dr. Rob Beaglehole. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.